Hello, and welcome to episode 114 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We are here today with Josh Lipsky, former special advisor to the Undersecretary of State in the Obama administration. From 2009 to 2011, Josh Lipsky was the associate director of Press Advance at the White House. He also worked in the East Wing of the White House on press issues. Josh Lipsky is also involved in local issues on the Montgomery County Charter Review Commission. Josh, thanks so much for joining us today. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me, Jordan. Happy to be here.
Glad to have you. The first question I'd like to pose to you is, what are you currently doing or what have you ever done to advance the public interest and why?
Great. Well, again, happy to be here and thanks for having me. What I've done to advance the public interest is work on campaigns and in political administrations and in the White House for people I believe in, and to help them. And so when I started out, I worked for Congressman Sam Farr from California. I believed in what he was doing.
You were doing that in high school?
That was in high school, yes. I was 15, and I wasn't even supposed to be able to work on Capitol Hill. You're supposed to be 16, but they didn't, you know, follow the rules that closely. My first day of work was September 10th, 2001.
Oh my goodness.
So the next day the world changed, which for me really instilled a desire to pursue foreign policy. Just seeing what happened on Capitol Hill those next 2 years with Afghanistan and the run-up to Iraq. And so I made it my mission through college and working on the Kerry campaign to work for candidates who were opposed to the Iraq war.
Can you elaborate for a minute exactly on what happened in Congress on the morning of September 11, 2001?
So I wasn't there that morning because I was going every other day, but I went in, it's probably 2 days later, and it was chaos, and my colleagues who were there who told me about it, it was absolute chaos. I mean, people running, told to evacuate the Longworth House office building, and they thought they were running for their lives because we believed and they believed there was a plane headed for the Capitol, and that is still somewhat disputed, but it may be the case, and that's the plane that went down in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. So in that moment, when they were told, run, I was told, and people told me and my friends, that it was absolute pandemonium.
Now, for our listeners who don't remember quite exactly, September 11th wasn't just in New York City. There was a plane that hit Washington, D.C. at the Department of Defense's Pentagon office building.
Right.
So Josh Lipsky is talking about the fourth plane that went down in Pennsylvania that may have been targeting the U.S. Capitol building.
Right.
So pandemonium.
And then I came in a couple days later, back to work, and I remember there was the anthrax scare, which you might remember. And so they made us take a medicine called Cipro. So I was the intern opening the mail. I had these latex gloves on, a mask, taking this medicine. My mom was freaking out. Like, what did I set my son to do? I was eager to do it. You know, I thought, I'm on the front lines here of making sure American democracy goes forward in my very, very small way, opening the mail. So anyway, this is a long way of answering your question about what I've done for public service. So it instilled in me a passion about foreign policy. And so I got involved in the Kerry campaign and then the Obama
campaign. When you were in college?
Yeah, Kerry campaign was my senior year of high school.
Of high school already?
Yes.
Now, is it unusual for middling teenagers to get involved in the U.S. Congress and presidential campaign?
It's somewhat unusual.
How is it that you came to take this initiative? Was your mom or dad involved in one of the campaigns?
No, they weren't.
So how was it that it occurred to you?
Well, I mean,
you didn't even have a driver's license. How did you get there?
I didn't have a driver's license. My mom would pick me up after school and take me to the metro. So that's how I got down to the Hill. It's a good question how it occurred to me. I always was obsessed with politics. My dad, when I was a little kid, would take me down to the Senate. We're from this area, from Potomac. So I remember watching Ted Kennedy speak on the Senate floor, John Kerry speak on the Senate floor.
And this was fun for you?
This was fun for me.
So other boys were going to play soccer and go to the movies and go on a date with a little girlfriend.
Yes.
You were headed down to the U.S. Senate's gallery to watch senators give speeches.
That's about right. I mean, I did play baseball here and there.
Well done.
And my, you know, my now wife will tell you, because we went to high school together, I had to skip a dance I guess it was our senior year, because I went out to Iowa to knock on doors for Kerry. And I had actually...
And how did she take that?
Well, we weren't dating then, so she didn't mind. And my plan in my senior year of high school was to work for the Kerry campaign.
Yeah, and your mom said, well, you know, I want to upend your plan and send you to college. And you're like, what are you doing, Mom?
I'm going to the Kerry campaign. So we worked out a little compromise where I worked for the Carrie campaign in New Jersey. I went to College of New York. And that was for that first 3 months, you know, till the election.
And then you could just be like a normal student.
And then I got to be a normal student.
Have you ever been normal? Has anyone ever accused you of that?
No, not really. Have, you know, since I was five, they said you're obsessed.
Precocious.
That's a good word to describe it.
So you're working on the Kerry campaign and you go through college and then what happens? Somehow you're on Air Force One pretty much before you get your bachelor's degree.
Oh, so big leap how to get there. So the relationship with Obama started in 2004. I was working on the Kerry campaign, and I got to go to the convention in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And my best friend in high school, this guy named Ben Bradlow, said, listen, there's this state senator from Illinois named Barack Obama. He's giving the keynote at the convention.
Mm-hmm.
If you happen to see him, would you get an autograph for me? I'm a big fan. I said, Ben, it's like 20,000 people to see him, but sure.
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't really know much about
him. He was a state legislator.
He was a state senator in Illinois.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And Kerry had picked him to give the keynote. So, sure enough, I end up being a credentials checker, which is someone who stands at the outside of the gate, basically making sure people have the right badge to get into whatever area. And they put me backstage. And I was just, you know, bowled over. There was Ted Kennedy, and there was Tim Russert, and there was Bill Clinton. And about an hour before the keynote, Barack Obama walks in. And he's just standing there by himself, going over his notes.
Mm-hmm.
And I went up to him and I said, Senator, I'm so sorry to bother you. My name's Josh. My best friend's a big fan. Would you mind giving me an autograph? And he said, sure. He signed it, said, to Ben, all the best, handed it back. And he said, would you like an autograph too? And I said, no, I'm good. Which I have long lived to regret.
Really left an impression on him. Yeah. Did he remember that?
Oh yeah, it's been joked about since.
Okay.
With staffers and friends.
I'm good.
So of course then he, you know, gave the speech, captivated the nation. I was captivated. And I knew if he ran for president, I wanted to be part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I followed the campaign closely.
So you weren't ever tempted by Edwards, or Dodd,
or Biden, or there was a big crew.
Or right? Vermont, that guy. Anyway.
Dean was 04.
Okay, so anyways, you had your man.
Yes, I had my man.
Okay.
I was excited when he announced. I would have been a junior in college. Or is that summer, really, junior year,
mm-hmm.
junior to senior
so
year.
So were you still able to do your assignments at school?
Not particularly well. It was a big case of senioritis and wanting to be on the campaign.
Right. So eventually you walked to graduation, kissed your mom, waved to the cameras, and ran the heck over to the campaign as fast as you could.
That's basically exactly right. I was on a plane to St. Louis, I think the day after the inauguration. I mean, yeah, the graduation.
Okay.
I'm in inauguration mode, so.
Yeah.
So joined the campaign, was on the advance team, which for your listeners is the group of people that travels ahead of the candidate and prepares their events.
Now, could any college graduate, what year was this?
This was 2008.
So could any college graduate in 2008 hop on a plane the day after graduation and join presidential candidate Obama's advance team?
No, I was fortunate because a good friend of mine who was a year older than me at Columbia was on the campaign very early.
Hmm.
So she was on the advance team and she got me involved in it. And that's how
So you just slipped the resume which says, you know, even though I graduated yesterday, literally, I've been involved in politics for 10 years.
I was talking to the campaign months before I graduated with the intent to join as soon as I humanly could. I would have joined before graduation, but again, my mom was the voice of reason on that one.
So, Missouri, here we go. Josh Lipsky in the show me state, and you show up there, and what happens?
I show up there, I didn't know what to expect. I knew sort of what advance was, because I had talked to people, I read
mm-hmm.
about it,
mm-hmm.
And I had known from the Kerry campaign people had done advance. And I just fell in love with it. You travel a few days ahead of the candidate. You find where they're going to speak. So they say, you know, Barack Obama wants to speak to 5,000 people in St. Louis. Okay, well, let's do it. Let's find a field. Let's find a baseball field. Let's find a gym.
How do you find 5,000 people?
The field
is more stationary,
Barack
right?
Barack Obama, it was not particularly difficult.
Really?
Just send the announcement out. And
people even knew about him in the very beginning.
Well, by the time I had joined the campaign, it was May 08. So he was closing in on the nomination.
Oh, I
so
see.
So I had done organizing throughout that year.
Mm-hmm.
But now, you know, the the rocket ship had launched.
Because he won election in November 2008. So right. He was on the cusp of beating Hillary Clinton
That's
for
right.
the nomination when you joined the team.
That's right. It was about a month out.
So he was getting national press coverage. He was
sure.
well known at that
past
point.
Past Iowa.
Okay.
Yeah.
So. He wasn't the unknown state senator. He was a U.S. senator who was almost about the Democratic
exactly.
nomination.
And there were, you know, these crowds, and it's well documented. I mean, I know
we're
we
big.
Like to talk about crowds now.
Yeah.
President Trump, but these were crowds.
Yeah.
These were, you know, St. Louis, not that event, but other event.
So you would pull, you would find a venue.
Find a venue, build the crowd, and I dealt with the press. That was my responsibility.
And what does that mean to deal with the press?
So the first step of dealing with the press is creating the visual layout of the event. Basically, the idea is that if you were to turn off the TV and see the then senator speaking, you would know and you would have a feel for what he was speaking about. So it's visual.
You mean
politics.
Without audio?
Without audio.
So you'd have the TV on, but you were to mute the TV.
So you would see the flag. You would see the crowd. Maybe you'd see union workers behind him if it was a labor speech.
Mm-hmm.
It's optics, visual politics.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the first stage of what we do, press advance.
Mm-hmm.
And then we deal with all the reporters that want to come and cover it and all their issues and logistics and operations, making sure they can broadcast live.
So are you saying, like, you guys stand over here, construction workers in the background,
sure.
CBS, NBC, we want you to have these chairs over here.
We do all that. We want you to shoot from here to here. We want this flag here.
And they have to listen to you?
Well, reporters don't like to listen to political staff in general, so there's some wrangling and back and forth going on.
Mm-hmm.
But we do the best we can to create the image we want.
Okay.
And that's really what press advance is. And I did it for 6 months, from May through November.
And then what happened in November?
So I was very fortunate.
Well, he became president. That's what happened.
Good news for the country, in my opinion. And so I was fortunate. I was relatively junior on the campaign because I had joined in May, and a lot of people had joined a lot earlier. But in July of 2008, he decided to do a foreign trip. So this is about 3 months before the election.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was that it was going to show him as a president, not just a senator, traveling overseas.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult to pull off a foreign trip when you're a senator because you don't have the support of the White House and the operation that is kind of required to do.
But at the time, the White House was Republican.
The White House was Republican, and they're not going to support, you know, a senator. If the senator wants to go to Israel or Jordan or Germany,
he's allowed to go on a vacation.
Sure, but they're not, you know, the embassy is not, you know, it's very different when you're a senator.
Right.
One of 100, and they'll come and say hi to you and, you know, give you an itinerary, but that's the extent of their responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
So we had the advance team go to different countries, and they sent an email out and said, does anyone speak any of these languages of the country we're going? And I speak Hebrew because I went to Jewish day school. And I said, I speak Hebrew. And they said, all right, Josh, you could go to Israel. And I was so happy all the years my mom forced me to learn Hebrew that I complained about and were finally paying off for me. And so through that trip, I got to meet more senior people on the campaign. We had some kind of crazy experiences at the Western Wall that I don't want to take up too much time, but some big...
A crazy experience might be fun.
I'll do it as briefly as I can. Basically, the president... The senator then was supposed to go to the Western Wall and leave a note in the wall in the morning.
Which is a tradition that many people do.
It's a tradition.
For those who don't know, the Western Wall in the city of Jerusalem is a former retaining holding wall for the original temple, Jewish temple on the Temple Mount,
exactly.
Which was the holiest site for the Jewish people.
And it's the only remnant of that original structure.
Mm-hmm.
So it contains a lot of importance to the Jewish people and to, you know, monotheistic religions around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so he, as is the tradition, before he left, was going to go put a note in. And we had set it up that the photographers who traveled with him,
mm-hmm.
we call them the traveling pool,
mm-hmm.
Would be able to get that picture. It's a very important image for us, for the country, for the campaign, to see this senator placing that note in the wall.
Mm-hmm.
So I was at the wall about 3 a.m, waiting for him to arrive. And these two Israeli photographers were in the position I had got the Israelis to promise me the American photographers could stand at.
Yeah.
And I'm saying to them, hey guys, in English, I'm saying, guys, you know, you need to rotate when the Americans come. This was our agreement. It's very important for us to have this.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying, okay, no problem, kol beseder, they say in Hebrew.
What does that mean?
It means all okay, don't worry, you know. And so president gets there, senator gets there, and comes down there. He's at the wall, and he's about to place a note in, and these guys aren't moving.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm yelling at them in Hebrew, but I'm about as far from Obama as I am to you. So I got to be
for our listeners, which is what? a few feet.
3-4 feet, you know. So I got to be sort of silent, but in my undertone, I'm saying, move, you know, and I'm using some Hebrew words that I learned, you know, through the years, and they're not doing anything. So I tell the Associated Press photographer, just stick with me. Mm-hmm. Just do what I do. Mm-hmm. And I tell the Israeli guy one last time, I said, we have an agreement, move right now, or I'll make you move. Doesn't move. So I elbow him in the back, he lets out a yelp, and I take the Associated Press photographer's camera strap, and I pull him on top of the Israeli guy who's bent over and paid. So he's kind of on top of this guy, snaps the shot, moves back. The Israeli, you know, guy's freaking out at me. The senator looks at me like, what is going on over here with my staff? And sure enough, the front page of New York Times, Washington Post, USA Today, the next day above the fold was that picture of him on top of the Israeli photographer.
And so, it all started with an elbow in the gut.
Yes. It was gentle, but it... effective.
Gentle, I'm sure. Didn't win very many friends with the press corps in Jerusalem,
No, but the American press corps was quite appreciative of my efforts. And so anyway, I met folks more senior on the campaign from that.
So that's what the public interest can look like. In a sense, public service can be throwing an elbow from time to time, well, literally.
You know, sometimes they say if you throw one elbow once, you don't have to do it again.
Yeah.
If you do it on national TV, you've made the point. So anyway, when he won and got to the White House, some folks asked me if I would join their team. And it was folks I had met on that trip in Israel. And that's how I ended up in the White House.
And that's how you ended up actually doing the Visitors Welcome Center.
That's right.
For the East Wing.
That's right. And we handled all the sort of public events. So Easter egg roll, steak dinner, social events.
Sounds exciting.
It was a lot of fun. You know, for me... being,
you're a grown-up who does Easter egg rolls for a living.
I was 20, 22, 23, and around 4 and 5 year olds for weeks at a time, and I kind of loved it.
Yeah.
It was a great job, and I got to walk around the White House all day, and can't complain about that. It was a real privilege.
What were your hours?
It was all the time. You just were there all the time. I would show up, you know, some mornings 4 or 5 in the morning.
Did you have roommates in a house that you rented?
We did. So I lived with 3 other guys who also worked at the White House. So we all were in different offices, mm-hmm. And we're best friends to this day. And we had met on the campaign. Mm-hmm. And so 4 of us lived in Logan Circle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you just, I guess... how bike over to the White House or something?
I walk down from 15th Street most days. About a 20-minute walk. So
yeah.
It's pretty good. That was my exercise.
All right. Well, so then you end up getting pretty involved with the press. And ultimately, you work at the State Department. How does that really... How does that come to pass?
So this is sort of by, you know, somewhat zigzag of a career journey. After working in the White House for 2.5 years, which was a complete honor... and I got to travel around the world, I really wanted to be involved more substantively in policy decisions that were being made. And so I went to law school and public policy school. I left the White House, which was a hard decision for me. But it was time to step back and, you know, do something different. And I did that. And when I left and finished grad school, I talked to folks in the administration. And the work I had done was on national security law and public policy. And they told me about this office of the State Department, which I knew about, counters propaganda. Counters Russian propaganda, counters ISIS propaganda. Mm-hmm. And I interviewed for a role there, and I ended up having just an incredible experience the last year and a half.
So just to summarize that, you were doing press and Easter egg rolls. You end up getting 2 graduate degrees, one in D.C., one in Boston.
Right.
And then you come back to help operate America's propaganda arm.
Yes, although we would say counter-propaganda, but yes, we don't do propaganda, we do information.
I see. Others do propaganda, we do information.
That's right.
Do you suspect that a Russian-born Moscovite might say that they do information and we do propaganda?
I will tell you that I went to Moscow not that long ago, and they will tell you very explicitly that we do propaganda, no uncertain terms about it. And
have you ever met your counterparts?
Well, they I've met some people in their offices. It's a little hard to say who would be a direct counterpart, but yeah, we've met...
what do they say?
That the U.S. does propaganda, and they do information.
And what would you expect?
More details there. Elaborate. What was there? Why did they think they were right and we were wrong? Why did they think that their information is accurate and ours is inaccurate? What were they saying about your job? Did they ask, are you immoral? How could you do this?
No, no. What they will tell you, not sort of in public, but what they will tell you, and I can share with you, is that their whole strategy is not about just getting their side out. Because a lot of the Russian people don't trust the Russian government. Their strategy is about making you not trust everyone else. Sure, you can't trust us, the Russian government, but you can't trust CNN, and you can't trust the American government, and you can't trust the New York Times. They cloud the information space. They muddy it. And therefore, you don't know what's real and what's not. And we're seeing that right here, today in the United States. And that's the Russian propaganda strategy, disinformation, as they say. Disinformation. They confuse you. And in doing that, they make you not trust any facts. Our strategy is very different in the United States. We believe in journalism. That's why we spent $800 million on Voice of America and the Broadcasting Board of Governors. Those are independent journalists that don't take direction from the White House or the State Department. They often criticize the White House and the State Department, even though they're taxpayer-funded.
And what would the Russian propaganda office say about Voice of America?
That it's U.S. propaganda.
That they're not independent, that it's a sham.
It's a sham, and they have a veneer of independence so I can say things like they're independent, but the truth is they're just U.S. propagandists all over the world.
Now, would you say those propagandists who you've spoken to in other countries, we're taking Russia as an example, do you think that they're trying, that in their minds they're advancing the public interest?
Sure. I mean, I'm sure that they have rationalized that to themselves.
They think that you're not.
Well, I think,
or do they think that you also are advancing the public interest and just disagree on how to do it?
I think that if, it's hard for me to get into the mind of a Russian propagandist, but I think if you were to really talk to them, they don't think about public interest the way we think about public interest in the United States. They think about Putin's interest, they think about the Kremlin's interest, and they believe by protecting him and that institution, they are doing what's best for the people, because he knows best what's for the people. So they wouldn't phrase it the way we think about it in terms of values and rights and democracy. They think when we use those terms, it's just nonsense, that we're just saying that.
Do you think is their impression that we are deluding ourselves?
They think that we're like them, we just won't admit it. All you care about is protecting the White House. All you care about is protecting the president. You don't care about freedom of the press. You don't care about human rights. We do. And we say it to them in private, and we take actions to insist on it, but that's their belief.
So off the Russians and back to you, Josh. We're nearing the end of this podcast episode, and I'd like to ask you to reflect upon your years of service. Now, unlike some of our other interviewees, we are going to have Voice of America on this podcast as well, and unlike other interviewees who may be in their eighth or ninth generation or decade of life, Josh, you're somewhat younger. You're a millennial.
Thank you. You
have hopefully a great and an illustrious career ahead of you, but yet you have accomplished much for your relatively young age. So what I'd like to ask you is to speak to our listeners for a moment. And some of our listeners may be college students trying to figure out what they want to do in life. Others may be individuals who have always pursued their own career but never really thought about public service, maybe thinking about trying to do something their own. If you could take a minute and talk to our listeners about what it is you recommend. Why is it you believe in this path of yours so much? Why is it that you've set yourself up for hopefully for the rest of your life to continue in this trend? What is so important about public service that has made you make all these decisions and sacrifices and miss your 12th grade school dance
in order to
advance the public interest?
My piece of advice to people that I didn't intend this in the beginning or set out, is to do what makes you happy while helping people. Do what you are passionate about. And I'll give the example of Barack Obama. He was not expected to get the nomination. The smart thing would be to not go work for him, to work for Hillary Clinton or someone who's expected, if you were just thinking about your career. But if you think about who inspires you, if you think about the cause you believe in, it doesn't matter if it pays a lot. It doesn't matter if you can see what job you'll get from it. You'll be happy. And if you're happy, you'll do a better job. If you do a better job, things will work out for you. And so whatever it is, it can be in politics, it can be in healthcare, whatever sector you're in, don't just think about how it sets you up for the next thing. Think about if you're being fulfilled. And I promise you, if you do that, everything will work out.
And that has been Josh Lipsky, former special advisor to the Undersecretary of State under the Obama administration, former associate director of Press Advance, former White House staffer in the East Wing, and a member of the Montgomery County Charter Review Commission, who speaks about public service as a means of personal self-fulfillment. Could have as easily been medicine or law. He is an attorney. Could have been an architect. Could have been helping the animal shelter. But for Josh, this has been politics, has been his passion. That is where he has found fulfillment. And he has an array of exciting, interesting stories. And you can tell in his voice that he really loves what he does. And even if it has required 90-hour weeks, even if it required various sacrifices over the course of his life to date, he really has made the decisions that have been self-fulfilling. And in seeking to be self-fulfilling, he's also done a great deal of good in the world as he sees it. So, Josh, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Jordan.
And this has been episode 114 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. Please join us at publicinterestpodcast.com, on your podcast app, on Apple products, or on iTunes. You can reach out to Josh by leaving a voicemail on a number that you can find in the Contact Us tab on the webpage. And we thank you again for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time.